Welcome to the Zero Input Agriculture podcast. Today I have an incredibly talented and motivated and experienced guest in the world of temperate tree crop breeding. Alex Tenke was highly recommended to me by a good friend and former guest, and I've delved into a bit of the many, many things that he is doing, but I think I will throw over to him to tell us a bit about himself because I think I've only just kind of glance the surface of all the work that he's doing. So, Alex, tell us a bit about yourself and how you ended up in this very remarkable, specialized kind of path in life.
Hey, thanks, Shane, for having me on the show. I guess one thing I would want to correct about the introduction is I am not experienced. I am so young. I'm only 28. I've been farming full time for 6 years, and I've been. I guess my first experience with the hickory was when I was like five, picking up hickory nuts with my dad at the local park. But that's still I'm still a youngin', but I do have a lot of very old teachers, like very, very old teachers. But yeah, so I'm fairly new to the game, but I've been going at it 100%, and I feel somewhat qualified in some regions. But thank you.
Are there more people coming to tree crop breeding earlier in life? Because it feels like annual crops, 10 years of your life, you can achieve a lot. But with tree crops, there is such a different culture and dynamic. And does having like extra decades ahead of you compared to someone who like picks it up in middle age when they're, retired, and how is that, how does that play out differently?
Yeah, it's really nice to be young. I can like plant a tree and expect to actually get a lot of crop. Like, so I planted some, this is getting a little off introductions, but I planted some grafted hickories today in my fields, and I'm expecting reasonable crops off of those in 20 years. I will be 50 when that is happening, right? So like I'm expecting to go around and like with my cane, and 50 isn't that old, but the way I work my body, I'll be broken down by then. It's really nice to be young. And I'm really lucky to have teachers that are a lot older and like people before me. But yeah.
Do you know
So
if that's
yeah,
becoming more common in like this
yeah.
generation of people getting into tree crops?
A lot of the people I work with are in their 30s. It does seem like there are some really young people. The NN the Northern Nut Growers Association had their youngest average age for their last meeting in New York ever by like a long shot. Like the average age was 40, and that's been the best ever. And they also had great attendance, like some of their best ever. So the youngest average age is definitely down. Probably there was one kid who was like trying to get into it professionally. He was 18, and he was. It's cool to see really young kids. So I don't, I've only gone to two meetings, NNGA meetings, maybe. Yeah, I think only two.
Well, it's one. It's
I can't say
wonderful
much
to
about
see.
that.
It's wonderful to see. So yeah, tell us a bit more about like what motivated you to start doing this.
That's kind of a long story to get into. I guess I started on a permaculture realm and then realized that like most of the trees and plants that are perennials that you can work with just aren't really worth working with. And like the classic example, the classic story for me is nanny berry. People are like, yeah, you can eat it and it's wild and it grows on its own. And no, not worth the time. And like even wild shagbark hickories, like barely worth the time to pick up. But I did recognize that like I loved them. Like even if they weren't worth the time, I loved them so much. And now they are worth the time. So I guess where I'm at right now is my life goal, other than just like having a good life, is to commercialize or make the hickory a staple crop for consumers and farmers, and subsistence farmers. So yeah, both as a commercial crop that you can buy in a store, and as a crop that can be useful on a home scale. That's my life goal, and that's where I'm at, I guess, now.
Am I right in picking up as well that this this tree crop culture in the eastern United States, it's really picking up a thread that was developed for thousands of years and was dropped during the colonization of the continent. And there's been like various waves of interest in it that have come and gone and come and gone. And this feels like the buildup of the most recent and most powerful wave so far of the what would you call it, resurrection of that culture.
Yeah, I guess you're referring to indigenous people
Yes.
working on the crop as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I believe indigenous people were working on the crop, most certainly, right? That said, the trees that were planted prior to colonization that I go to still, like, maybe they were planted by squirrels, but most of them just aren't very good,
Yeah.
which is fine. Like maybe the culture was just so different, and like maybe other people have different experiences. Maybe my region, what's left in my region, just isn't really worth working with. And I do know, like out east, at least the black walnut, probably other nuts, were introduced over there by indigenous people. And like I'm kind of in the Midwest, where I'm at is more of like the epicenter of biodiversity for these species
Yeah.
and for the nut species, because it's on the edge of prairie region and the forest region. And because of that, I think it's harder to breed in the epicenter
Yeah.
of genetics.
Yeah.
Um,
Yeah.
that's an unknown fact. And we have more germplasm to work with if we can breed. So yeah, we're definitely picking up on the thread. Like people have been working on this in the Northern Macros Association since the early 1900s. Yeah, J. Russell Smith, J.F. Jones, we're definitely sending germplasm to Carl Weschke, whose farm I go to regularly. And Carl Weschke, he died, or he grafted all of his trees in 1956. Plus or minus a couple of years, according to the tags. And those were picked up by Philip Rutter, and he planted out thousands. And of those, like 330 survived to this day. I might have killed a couple on accident. And, Philip Rutter didn't have the time to deal with them because he was busy with hazelnuts and chestnuts. And he actually said this in 1986 or 87, I believe, in an NNGA report. And then I'm taking over that work. So, yeah, like he hasn't really played too much with it, hasn't really dug into it too much, and then I'm digging into it. So it's, yeah, not only has it been wild, indigenous breeding, and but it's been three at minimum, probably four more generations of
Since,
work or
yeah.
collaboration since starting in early 1900s, and here we are today, and I think we're close. I think we're
Could
close to having something worth playing with.
this be one of the long-term superpowers of tree crops? Like with annual crops, if there's a big disaster and people stop growing them, it's very easy to lose that germplasm. But with tree crops, if they're scattered over the landscape and some of them last for hundreds of years, you can come back to a tradition that gets interrupted and find those, special trees to start propagating from again.
Totally, yeah. Speaking of like losing stuff, and the book Endangered Maize by Helen Ann Curry, have you read that book?
No, I'll have to look it up.
If you could interview Helen, she is the best. Helen talks about the way that corn and wheat and rice, but mainly corn, were just like put into seed banks, and then they're forgotten about, and they're like useless unless they're in the world. And yeah, tree crops, they can stick. That said, like Carl Weschke had a plum orchard, he had a pear orchard, he had hazelnuts on his farm, he had, chestnuts supposedly somewhere. All the pears are gone, all the apples are gone, all the plums are gone. They all got taken over by the weed trees. The hickories held through for sure. They're getting a little crowded, they're fine. The black walnuts, they're doing okay. Some of the chestnuts are okay that didn't die. But then the one problem with tree crops, especially nut tree crops, is timber is highly valuable. And Carl Weschke's farm was logged about 12 years ago. Luckily, that was after Philip Rutter got his germplasm. So what I'm working with at Carl Weschke's farm is like at most half of what was there when Philip Rutter was collecting. So yeah, they can persist. I wouldn't expect that from small trees or shrubs like hazelnuts. I think I found like three hazelnuts on Carl Weschke's farm, and that was one of the major sources of germplasm for from Badger Set or for Badger Set.
Well, do you want to tell us about the two or three crops that you work on the most? I want to know the whole process, like how you source the original genetic material and how you manage and how you select, because it's a nitty-gritty detail that very rarely gets talked about in these kind of podcasts.
Yeah. So I work with three crops, honey locust, American persimmon, and hybrid hickory. The honey locust, I just got a ton of seed from one planting with the best germplasm and then planted a ton of seedlings. And then anytime someone is like, I have a new clone, I'm connected with the networks and I, clone them in my nursery and put them out in the field. I'm done with honey locust. I don't have time for it. I'm done. The seedlings that I planted were the most from the most diverse planting of honey locust that I know with the best genetics, like an isolated fashion. The American persimmon, I just like I'm planting out beds of American persimmon in my field, 4 foot wide beds, 3 rows per bed, 3 inches between seed and row, 9 inches between rows, and I'm just like planting just over 100,000 of that, and I'm sourcing that from the best germplasm repository that I can find for American persimmon, which is Jerry Lehman's property. And I've got these planted. We'll see what they do in 10 years. I'm done with it. I did collect some germplasm from Twin Tykes, which is just, high production clones crossed by Zucchus, or any male flowers from those female production clones. And then I did plant some seed from Don Compton's, but most of the seed I have is from Jerry Lehman's property
I'm curious with
because he
those
was
American persimmons, with that really dense planting, what stages of selection are you hoping to put them through? Because, like, obviously they can't all grow to like full size, so most of them have to fail along the way.
Yeah, just anything I can find, any problems I can find with them. I don't want to get too much into them. I mean, like stem dieback can be an issue. You want thick stems because thick stems can be associated or are associated with larger fruit for reasons I can't fully explain. But an old guy told me this who is neurodivergent in an incredible way, and I trust what he says. He's a genius.
He's
He
the
has some insight
diasporos
into plants.
whisperer.
Yeah, David Pierce, he is so smart. He's off the inner, he's off the world. But if you go to his machine shop or like his warehouse of stuff, like you would not believe the experiments he has going on in there. And he's figured out stuff about American persimmon disease, particularly sudden death syndrome, which we've renamed persimmon decline, or he wants to call it Pierce's disease after himself. He's figured some stuff out about that researchers never would have figured out, and like he can cure it. And I just tipped off the Savannah Institute to this, and they're going to do some the final stage of research. Like he has cured trees. He knows a procedure. He's been doing it for years. And now we just need some actual control, like research experiments on that.
Do you think there could be genetic resistance to that problem too?
There is, yeah, the cat. This is kind of, let's see, we're going down a sidetrack. The if I could, if anyone's listening to this, do not do what I did. Do not plant American persimmon seedlings in the north. The American persimmon is probably never going to be a viable commercial crop. It might be a fine subsistence crop. I love the fruit leather. I eat like 20 gallons a year worth of pulp in fruit leather form. It's my favorite fruit in that way. That said, if you can play around with anything, play around with hybrid persimmons. They are more susceptible to persimmon decline. But yeah, the hybrids have variable resistance to it. And the fruit quality is just spectacular. You can get some crazy traits. There's one, David Pierce has a small hybrid orchard. I shouldn't be saying this too much, but he calls this tree Alex after me, and I call it David's Best after him. So we're in a fight to figure out which name it is.
Well,
But
I
this
can
tree, yeah.
no, no, tell me about the tree. Tell me about the tree. Sorry.
Okay. So this tree, David's Best, it's the one tree in his orchard that I like am stoked about, and there's a couple of reasons. So they're Roseanca back crosses to quality males, which he just o had open pollinated in his orchard. They're all 75% American, 25% khaki. And this particular tree, it is fairly vigorous. It wants to grow up like an American. It has really large fruit, kind of flat, like the non-astringent khaki persimmons. And the two weird things about it, again, I've only observed it 1 year. This is not a good way to do breeding. But this tree, on the limbs that are bearing, it bears very heavily. The fruit fall before they are ripe when they are hard, like very hard. You do not want to eat them. They drop, they ripen off the tree beautifully to the
Oh,
pure
wow.
khaki flavor. They fall with their calyx on. And if you pick them very early, like rock hard green, they still taste wonderful when they ripen in a bag. So they have all these traits of productivity. They drop early. Like maybe we'll be with American persimmons, there's a couple of good trees. And they're unreliable good trees, I think, because of this. They drop Proc A118, Proc and A118, and I believe Piper all seem to drop. I have less experience with Piper because it's later. They seem to drop a little early when they're hard, and that's what keeps them from splatting. H63A, like most persimmons, they hit the ground and they obliterate. You cannot pick them up, and you do not want to, especially if it's warm and there's wasps everywhere. Proc and A118, they drop early. Last year, and this ha seems to happen regularly with Proc, they'll drop so early that it's astringent. And you could ripen it off the tree, but this is never going to be a production system. And A118 drops so reliably early that it's like just horrible. But this David's Best, it drops so early and so hard that there's no bruising, and you could just pick it up and ripen it on the counter, and it tastes like khaki. It's awesome. So we could have these tall American form, or he's been pruning his trees. Maybe we could get a khaki system that, and it's 75% American. Maybe it's definitely more hardy than Roseanca. Definitely, Roseanca is really susceptible to persimmon decline. This one's very resistant. Anyway,
Can
that's
I
a little sidetrack.
pick? I'm curious to pick your brain about potential for other interspecies hybridization in the Diospyros genus, because I'm in the subtropics here. I could even grow maybe Mabolo, the Philippine edible delicious persimmon, if I can find the right spot for it. And given that American and Asian persimmons hybridize with potential benefits, I wonder if anyone's cast a wider net.
So there's a couple. If you're going to go down this track, I have some advice. The first thing, with the khaki and the American hybrid, it was very, very difficult to get that first interspecific cross.
Oh, it
And
always is.
yeah, and some little tricks is you can like microwave the pollen of the same species to get the same. I don't know if people have talked about that, but
Yeah,
microwaving pollen of the
mental pollination.
same. So get your microwave running and watch out for
Well,
the radiation,
apparently
whatever.
freeze thaw cycles can do it as well. You can kill
Well,
the cell but keep all the proteins intact.
yeah. So there's something like that. There might be. I think you have to do like embryo rescue and stuff like that. I'm not going to get into it. You should. The more species mix you can do, the more messed up stuff happens. And that's the whole badger set tradition. This is all Phillips teaching. This is new stuff.
Well, I mean, look at
And
apples.
there's
They've got probably five different wild ancestors that have gone into the modern domestic population.
So it's just so helpful for breeding when you get messed up stuff from genetic mutations. And yeah, like there's one hickory I call it like turkey foot or fourth finger or something. It's the only tree that I've ever seen, and I've talked to other people who work with hickories, do controlled crosses. It's the only tree that instead of just having three catkins on a cluster, it has a fourth kind of at the base. It's just messed up, and it's like obviously a messed up hybrid. The kernel percentage varies, but it tends to be like just below pre it's not a particularly useful tree other than for milking, but it does seem to hammer out a great crop really reliably, and it's pollen fertile, which is really rare in my for my selections, and it's messed up enough that I want to breed with it. So if you're going to breed with these interspecific hybrids, look for the messed up trees. That's how you make jumps in breeding. Don't necessarily look for good normal trees.
Well, that's a good place to shift and talk about hickories, because this is a huge diverse genus and you're in the middle of its range, and they hybridize fairly readily, and there's a history of that process being used to create superior production lines. What are you doing with hickories? I'm so jealous because we've only got like a couple of paperbark pecans here in the subtropics. They grow amazingly, but the birds just completely obliterate them in Australia. And I wish I could get my hands on all of the genetics that you have in the US, but it's just impossible.
Yeah, hickory or pecans and pecans are definitely co-evolved with the crow and the jay, probably as well. The birds will hammer them. That is an issue.
Well, we've
Like,
got
you can
parrots.
have a
We get thousands of parrots
whoa.
arrive, and they'll just strip a tree of
No.
green, in 5 minutes.
Oh, no. Oh, no. So with shagbark hickories, it's pretty much the small nuts. I think just the there's one bird that I've seen pick them up. It's the nuthatch, I believe. Yeah, it's got to be the nuthatch. And then I've heard foxes eating them and dogs eating them. But other than that, it's squirrels, mice, chipmunks, that kind of stuff. And at Badger Set, it's so nice. Okay, at Carl Weschke's, there's red squirrels, there's gray squirrels everywhere. You really can't, every nut you pick up was dropped that day. At Badger Set, there's these people that hunt, and they say they just sit next to the hickories and they get out their shotgun and they watch all the squirrels come in across the cornfields. They migrate in, they swarm in, and they just pick them off one at a time. And they say that the best way to cook a squirrel is to burn off the hair and then rub it off. And then you get all the fat from the skin too. And the skin is really thick and nice. So I haven't done that yet, but that's what they swear by. And I know they're eating a lot of squirrel. So yeah, that's one advantage to working with shagbarks. That said, I don't think the birds, I'm not too experienced with bitternuts or yellowbud hickory. I don't think the birds mess with them too much though. But there is one hybrid between shagbark, possibly shellbark, but we'll figure out soon once we get our genetic testing back. It's called Paradise. That tree is hammered by the crows, even though it's a bitternut, probably shagbark cross, which is weird. It's like kind of acting like a pecan ecologically. And I'm a little bit afraid that my breeding path towards really thin shell hickories is going to lead to that issue.
Good thing you
Like,
like eating
yeah, maybe.
squirrel. Good thing you like the taste of squirrel, at least. There's a byproduct if the trees are too fragile.
Yeah. And like with squirrels, it's easy to kill them all. Like, you kill them and then they're dead and you eat them and it's great. But with you can't kill all the birds. You can't kill your thousand parrot hordes or the crow.
And parrots don't taste nice, so there's no incentive to catch them anyway. Not that we're allowed
Really,
to.
they don't.
No, they're just skin and bone. They're horrible.
They're not like chicken.
No, not at all. I wanted to ask, how do you control pollination in something like hickories that are wind pollinated? Do many people do like controlled hand pollination, like on the end of a cherry picker up in the air, or?
Yeah, almost nobody does that these days. I did my first controlled crosses last year on a tree at Badger Set called Shiver. And I knew I was pollinating him too early, but I spent an hour up in that tree with ropes and a harness on. And it sucks. It sucks to have a hypodermic needle full of pollen that you spent, days collecting all this stuff, and then you squirt it in, and you're like, you don't. You, I live 3 hours away from Badger Set, so I got to drive there every time. And I was like, oh, this is the only tree that I know none of the stigmas have opened up. Like the rest look receptive. Shivers really late in receptivity, and I injected all the pollen. Zero. Like I know what it looks like now to have no success, and which is actually an important thing to know. Like I know for a fact now that the time that the nutlets drop is, 3, 4 weeks later for at least that tree. And when I'm in the orchard and I'm seeing all these nuts drop 3 weeks after pollination, now I know, because I did those controlled crosses and failed, now I know, like, okay, that's actually just a fertilization issue, which can be a boron issue, or it can be a, actual pollen issue, which I don't think it's an actual pollen issue. Though that's what they say.
I mean, hen pollination is
Anyway.
another one of those techniques like grafting where you need to. There's so many little things that can go wrong that it takes a lot of trial and error to get a feel for when it feels like it's going right. And I mean, and again, it's not the kind of thing you can easily learn from a book, or even if someone has already done it extensively. It's one of these, I think the Greek call it metis, these tangible skills that are very difficult to intellectualize.
Yeah, I mean, I guess luckily I got connected with this guy named Warren Chatwin, who runs the USDA pecan repository, and he's doing genetic testing for us on our hickories. He's super stoked about what we're doing. And he taught me how to do controlled crosses, so I'm using all of his that equipment and that process. And he did a little demo. And like it's not that complex. Maybe learning receptivity times on the stigmas is a little tricky, but yeah, it's once you do something, it goes by. But yeah, then you can have your nuts taken away by weevils, you can have them taken away by squirrels, and you got to mark them, and somehow you got to, cage them, and then you got to figure out, okay, I pollinated 20 nuts on this tree. I can't mix those with the other nuts. It's a pain in the butt. I don't want to do that. So luckily, Philip Rutter gave me permission this year to cut out up to 50% of any tree I wanted, in the orchard. So I picked like 50 trees and just cut out 50% of the pollen producing canopy, which is, it's a start. It's not the end, but at least we're doing a couple of things by doing that. One, we're seeing what happens if you prune a hickory heavily. Does nut size go up? Does production go up on those branches? We'll see. Probably. And then, two, we're making biochar with all that, so that's great. And that was the one precondition to me being able to do any pruning on the hickories. And then, three, yeah, we're reducing the pollen cloud. And at least for that year, I do believe, and I think I know, that the catkins are set the year prior, but the stigmas and the nutlets are set the spring of the nuts are set the spring of the year that the nuts are produced. And Warren Chatwin told me this. He said, yeah, if you cut through the growing tip over and over, you'll see that they aren't differentiated until later. Which makes sense because they're on the tip of the current year's growth. But anyway, and then the catkins come out directly from the bud, as the bud breaks. So that should be differentiated the year prior. So I know at least this coming year, the pollen will be a little bit better. And I specifically chose those 50 trees, either being really, there were trees that were either really close to a tree that I like and I wanted to give it space, or those were pollen fertile trees. And I've gone through the whole orchard. All There's 130 trees that are productive in pollen or in nuts. Maybe it's 200 trees in pollen and 130 that were productive last year with nuts. And I know which trees are pollen fertile, and it's only 60% of the trees, so that's another way I can control pollen. Other than those trees in that orchard, there's a couple of bitternuts in the woods, like a mile away. Probably not an issue. And yeah, so that's not too much of an issue.
I have a really
There
interesting
is a
question. Oh, sorry, you hadn't finished.
the bitternuts in the woods, there's a timing difference in when pollen is dropped between shagbark and pecans and bitternuts. And the pecans and the bitternuts seem to be a lot later, is my initial observation. I got to do a little bit more work to like prove that for sure, but they do seem to be later, so that might influence certain trees more. But I do know which trees those are. And that also at my property, I don't have any bitternuts within a mile of my property. So the vast majority of the pollen will be coming from, 90 plus percent of the pollen will be coming from my orchard.
This was a question I've asked other tree breeders before, is how do you build up the decision-making process to cull trees, particularly when they're like start getting older and more mature, if they've gotten through the first hurdles of eliminating traits that you don't want? Because like often trees vary a lot from year to year in their performance. And I mean, that can be something in itself that you want to eliminate from your population. So yeah, like I'm starting to reach this stage. I've got loads of very, you probably think would be rubbish persimmons because we've got so little genetics to work with here, that are all starting to mature. And some years a tree will look amazing, and the next year it might be having a break. And keeping track of all of that information, either in your head or in records, how do you manage all of that?
Yeah, I have this massive Excel sheet. Massive. Just for Badger Set. So that's one way to get started. I've been watching those trees really intensively for 2 years and lightly for 3 years. So I have a good amount of data on the Badger Set trees. It is a little scary culling trees, and that's why I feel really good about just pruning 50% of the tree out. It gives me a good opportunity to keep watching it, kind of
It gets
in
a
like a
second chance
modified
to prove
format.
itself, just in case you made a
Totally.
mistake.
And with so Philip tells me a lot of stories about the hazelnuts and the chestnuts, and like he has a story about probably multiple stories about hazelnuts where he doesn't really like it, so he cuts it down, and then you always give it a second chance after Kapas, and because it's a hazelnut, it's just going to come back. And he said that some of his best producing plants on a single year basis came, it was like 3 years after a coppice, it produced the heaviest crop, and then it produces a good crop the year after, and then it produces almost nothing. So like there are just some genetics that, yeah, maybe we gotta like cycle it out. Probably useless, but it's still interesting. It is just scary making decisions, and hickories do somewhat come back. With my burning regimen, they aren't gonna come back. So
I'm
good.
starting to wonder if there's a way of marking trees in the field. Like every year you could have a different color tag, which indicates particularly good trees or terribly performing trees. And then after a few years, if those tags are durable enough, you can look at a tree and it'll kind of remind you, oh, it's had 3 good years in a row. This is a really good one. And another one might look good that year, but the last 2 years it's been a poor performer. Is that,
Yeah.
has anyone ever tried using that system?
Yeah, definitely a lot of people do that, especially in a nursery where you have small trees and you're just like looking for a stem dieback or something. I think that's good. There's a lot more data than like good and bad though. So I guess what I would suggest is having an organized system with ideally rows that, I mean, you gotta mow anyway, right? So I mean I hope you're mowing your orchard, or have a very rich ecology or
It's a
something around it.
very wild ecology here. I'm not a fan
Right.
of machinery, but I'm just a one solo I'm just doing the wild crosses. And not as
That's
focused on production. So yeah, I'm in a different mindset. You mentioned
awesome.
biochar. That's probably a good place to kind of segue through to low input. Like particularly tree crops, I think, have this promise that they can be a lot more efficient with their inputs than annual crops are traditionally. And even potentially in the long run, they could be zero input, depending on like market conditions and the price of inputs.
Okay, so I want to jump back a little bit
Oh yeah,
to
that's okay.
the mowing thing, and then I'll swing back to that. I don't like mowing. I just sickle mow everything. I'm doing experiments on making a richer ecology, but the whatever you plant in the understory has to make complete sense for the overstory if that is your crop, right? So like all I at Badger Set, half the orchard I have seeded to native forbs and grasses and sedges, and I'm going to manage it the best I can, only mowing in spots that I need to walk to reduce my, tick accumulation, because Badger Set is, I've gotten 300 ticks in 3 days at Badger Set. Nuts
Oh,
feed mice make ticks. So for me, I mow a little bit. I don't like mowing, but water is the number one thing that makes production. If you don't, anyway, so that's important to keep in mind. And then having a sensical system is important for just labeling. You can do that in a random pattern. But then think about when you die, if you're working with tree crops, when you die, who is managing your orchard and how are they going to do that? Are they going to manage it the same way than you as you? Are they going to want to get a tractor in there to mow it? Maybe
Just
they
take the
will.
whole lot out.
Yeah, they might just bulldoze it if it's too unorganized and just a mess. So something to consider if you're working with hickories or long-term tree crops. And then yeah, zero. I make a lot of biochar. Philip Rutter gave me a really good start at a design. Mark Hammond and I have been working on this aluminum culvert, fireplace sealant sealed kiln with fiberglass rope around the top layer, with cold rolled steel round tops. You can roll it to your site, you bury the bottom. Super easy to make biochar, ring of fire style, and then you just snuff. And I just unloaded the kiln and I was just spreading biochar on my newly planted hickories. Super efficient. I've sequestered 12 tons of CO2 this calendar year so far. I'm carbon neutral right now. I don't think I'll make it the rest of the year. So yeah, I mean that's a good way. I buy a lot of fertilizer. And the at Badger Set, on the zero input front, on Badger Set, there's a row of hickories called Row S, and that was planted at the same time as what we call the back hill. The back hill was almost never cared for. It was mowed occasionally, fertilized once with like a scoop per tree. And then the front row is fertilized with the same regimen as the hazelnuts that were given much more priority. The trees in the front row look like they could be parents of the back hill trees. They are way bigger, way more productive, and way more reliably productive. The trees in the front, you can tell that there's an entirely different like synchrony or like bearing schedule for those trees in the front. And you are there's there are a couple of annual bearers in the low input back hill on low fertility, but like the phosphorus levels are like 20 times lower than on in row S, and the boron levels need to go up. So like row S has not been fertilized in 7 years until last fall, but it was still bearing and growing way better. So yeah, you don't necessarily need inputs all the time, and they don't need to be that regular. And the soil, t but the soil tests are still coming back that they were the biology and something about row S changed enough from the fertilizer and the way that it was managed such that the organic matter is going up and the biology is still making a lot of fertility available on those soils. The back hill, total garbage. It's been sitting in tree crops for 40 years and it's not any better than it used to be. And also, trees don't really make soil more fertile. The fact of the matter is, like, prairie soils are the best soils, and that's from burning. Trees can make good soils via with our additional input of biochar, though. Like, but when you burn a prairie, that makes that makes pyrolyzed carbon, and that makes really good fertility. And makes the whole biology work entirely differently. So I've been burning the back hill. I'm gonna make biochar, and someday it'll be better than Row S. So
That strategic use of inputs as a catalyst, I think, is amazing. So yeah, it's a good thing to think about.
yeah, and definitely, yeah, using biochar as a catalyst, but then you still might have to wait 20, a lot of years to have that system jump started. One way of jump starting a system is just putting conventional fertilizer on. Sorry, I know a lot of people aren't going to like that, but like conventional fertilizer does go a long way in jump starting. You could go Alan Savory on some stuff and, bring your cows through and put some biochar on, and you could probably jump this j system that way. Or you could just like, or you could do both, just put a little fertilizer down, jump start the system that way, and get your system really, really good and keep it rolling. But yeah, I brought 10 semi loads of mulch from the city to my property last year. I got another 5 this year. Probably get another 5 in the fall. I paid $20,000 for fertilizer just on my property last year. Like, I'm jump starting some stuff. And
And I mean, I understand. I acknowledge that you're in a different situation. You're in the like the productive, like industrial side. You guys and that whole culture with the Northern Nut Growers Alliance is focused on turning these into real crops, not just a hobby in somebody's backyard that may or may not pay off eventually. So yeah, I see where you're coming from, and that makes perfect sense.
And even for the backyard farmer, like a little bit of pee and poop, like I keep all my pee, I keep all my poop. I got so many holes in my yard. Don't tell my neighbors that, because they would not be happy. And like we got 100+ gallons of urine in the garage. Like we're doing it all the, good normal way too, or the good healthy system way. But yeah, even if you put 10 gallons a year on your hickory tree in your backyard, you're gonna get way better results. 10 gallons a year, or just bury some poop in biochar. That really makes a difference, for all people. And I want my berries to perform in my backyard. I want my corn to perform. Even if you're just subsistence farming, it makes sense to have a consistent yield. I can give you an annual bearing tree like Weschke, and I can tell you with certainty that the Weschke variety is a hickory that is known to be an annual bearer. At a property in, I'm forgetting the name of the property, but at a property in Pennsylvania, that tree has been bearing consistently the past 5 years. Carl Weschke observed that tree the first 13 years of his life as bearing a crop heavily every year. I can say for a fact that the past 2 years at Carl Weschke's farm, his own Weschke trees have not borne more than 5 nuts. Like, the property is, it's being managed, but it needs a little bit more of a jump start, and it needs a little bit more water. And probably I view it like, if you're low on water, fertilizer can help, and it just anything you can do to reduce the stress on a tree. But water is the number one most important factor in productivity.
That's why we're in a kind of very different environment here. This used to be a rainforest before it was cut down to turn into a cattle paddock. So I'm turning it.
What?
We're in the subtropics, like up in a rainforest. And we got 30 centimeters of rain in the last 3 days.
Whoa.
But a few years ago, we got a meter of rain in 3 days.
Whoa.
So,
Oh, no.
if you can find the right plants for our weird mineral depleted soils, the amount of growth they can do is just it's almost terrifying. But then you have to find ways of redirecting that into the plants that can actually produce a crop. So I mean, like syntropic is kind of the model that works a bit better here, which is
Interesting.
a lot of labor, but yeah, it, I'm still figuring
I
it
mean,
out.
everything is different in different places. I don't know. I'm just on, prairie soils in the Midwest. I'm
Yeah,
like, but yeah,
I'm
I
very
totally
envious of
understand.
anyone who has soil that good and can do that much with it. So yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure biochar is really good for you.
Yes, absolutely essential. I cut lots of branches for my goats as fodder, and then all of that leftover biomass, all that woody biomass gets turned into char, and it's the only thing that improves soil for like annual production. It's really the only thing that does the job.
Yeah. And I want to share a little story about water, and how that relates to trees. So we do a lot of wild selection of trees. Me, Jesse Markson, Eric Cornell, Zach Alfers, all the people working on Buzz Alfer or Buzz River, all the people working on hickories. And we have a pattern of selecting for trees next to roads and rocks. Why?
Because that's where
Water.
the and mineral too, if there's road base
And
that's been
mineral, yeah.
brought in,
Plant material for sure. But like a big, there's one tree that Jesse and Eric call Sky Rock. It's because the tree has lifted a massive boulder up towards the sky. And the reason, like, it's suppressing all the grass, anything that would have grown in that area is pouring over and getting into the root systems of the tree. But yeah,
It's amazing how
and plant.
a little structure like that can double the amount of effective rainfall on that small patch of adjacent land.
Totally. Yeah, and by doubling the amount of rainfall, you're getting past a lot of the understory trees, so or understory shrubs or grasses too, which consume all the little amounts of rainfall, and then the trees get the big rainfall. So yeah, it's like totally rebalancing. I mean, stick rocks out in your field. I don't know. I'm just kidding. I hate rocks.
Now, tree crops have unusual demands when it comes to how social networks form and like how the work continues through history. So, and I'm kind of facing this with my attempts at domesticating some local staple tree crops. So I'm really curious about how that dynamic is managed in North America, where you've been at this for so much longer. Like how do you connect with other people and maintain productive relationships and also succession, like passing things on to the next generation? It's a different kind of problem to annual growers.
I forget. Did we talk about this on air or off air? Already, we talked about this a little bit earlier,
Yeah, I
but
think that was earlier.
it was all off air. Okay, thank you. Yeah, there's so many relationships. Things are really messy, complex at times. You know, it's all crazy. But yeah, you got to be friends with everyone, because and you got to share information, and that's really important. Our friends at Bread Tree, particularly Noah Simon, told me that while he was in Italy, he was told by some Italian, and they said the most important factor in the thrivingness of an industry is how much people talk and communicate to each other. So, yeah, we talk a lot. We communicate. I try to post everything I can on Facebook just to make it so that. Like I could die tomorrow. I chainsaw. Do prairie burns. I climb trees. Do controlled crosses. Doing planks. 40 feet above the ground. Like just dumb stuff. And I'm uninsured, so not a good situation. But yeah, we communicate a lot with the people who are actively doing the work right now. Philip Rutter teaches me so much. He's my main teacher, Mark Hammond, who he's doing hazelnut work, but we're just like always calling. And one thing I think that people know me for is having very quick calls, like 2 minute calls, like, hey, you got 2 minutes. And I'm just like, okay, so I'm thinking about this. And what are your thoughts on that? And there's so many good ideas that come out of two or three people having the same conversation. So there's definitely a lot of that. And then the intergenerational problem, at least breeding hickories, that's been going on since 1900, maybe a little bit earlier, just in the NNGA. And then indigenous people were working on it, at least to some extent, before that. Though, yeah, there's a lot of complexity and things we could go into on that. I'm just going to leave it at that. Thank you, or thank you to all the historic indigenous people. Sorry for everything we've done. And yeah, but starting in 1900, JF Jones, J. Russell Smith were working on hickories. They sent a lot of that germplasm to Carl Weschke. Carl Weschke did his own germplasm collection. Carl Weschke, whose orchard I go to still today, he put all of his germplasm in River Falls, Wisconsin, and I go there regularly. I have a relationship with the landowners. They're great, great people. And he made that germplasm repository, and then he died, and then Philip Rutter came along and took his germplasm, collected all the seeds, planted 1,000 at his property in the nursery. 300 are still alive today. And Philip Rutter didn't even really have time to work with the hickories. And frankly, some of them are just getting into production because they weren't cared for well. And Philip knew this. In 1987, he posted in the NNGA report that he only had time to work on the hickories. I believe it was the NNGA. He only really had time to work to work on chestnuts and hazelnuts, and would just kind of abandon the hickories and have other people come along for that. And then, yeah, in 2022, I came along and started taking over the work from there. And he's been a teacher to me. He's passed on so much information. I would be like nothing without his teachings in so many different ways. So thanks to Philip. And yeah, and I'm going to be putting my property in either a land trust or a conservation easement as soon as I can, because I could die anytime. And I don't want these trees being logged like Carl Weschke's farm. And you know, Philip Rutter's farm is probably going to be logged off at some point too. Hate to say it, but and you know, my farm will probably be logged off, hopefully by like someone who, if it's in a trust, it should be, you know, better off, but it'll be logged off by some well-meaning person who doesn't know what a good hickory is, even though they're trying to manage the hickory forest.
I mean,
So
it's a kind of pointed issue at the moment with all of the chaos in the US government unfolding. Institutions like the GRIN, their funding was already like, barely enough to function. And I think they got caught up in some of the early cuts and rationalizations of and it's interesting because it seems to be at odds with the intention to put the power back in the hands of smaller farmers to like decentralize and deindustrialize to maybe deindustrialize is too strong a word, but reduce the monopoly power of the mega corporations in agriculture in the US. But to do that, all of those smaller scale farmers need genetics and resources to like come up with a model that works in their local situation. And I just wonder if you have any thoughts on that, because I know that there's also like tree germplasm reserves as part of that system. Do you know if any of them have been impacted?
I don't know. I was just talking. I don't know. I don't follow the news. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah. One. Yeah. I don't know.
I guess it links to a broader topic about critical mass and decentralization. Like if you've just got one, Fort Knox where all of the treasure is stored, if anything goes wrong with that and it's a biological resource, once it's lost, if it's all in one place, it can be lost pretty much forever. And I wonder if the tree crop industry in your area is starting to reach a critical mass, that it's got that resilience that if any one node drops out, which it always does eventually, there's enough other nodes to kind of keep filling in the gaps and growing and grabbing those opportunities as they arise.
Yeah, I with hickories, I think Philip, for some, I'm kind of surprised Philip has let me clone his trees, but I think Philip has let me clone his trees because he knows a tornado could come at any moment and wipe out his orchard. It doesn't just have to be the banks taking away the farm, or you know, some you know asshole burnt setting the whole thing on fire. I don't sorry to swear. But yeah, it could happen at any moment. I think we're in a decent spot right now. And one thing I would like to mention, just because y'all do have a lot of, yeah, there's a lot of people who are doing small scale breeding work, is like it's way more useful to like the Weschke tree is preserved because it's in a lot of places, yes, but it's a lot more useful to the next breeder down the line to have a lot, not just the Washkee tree in one place, but also swaim and, all of the trees in one place. So for all those small scale breeders out there, if you can just work on like one or two crops and do that really well and have a good, I don't even want to call it a repository because I don't believe in a repository. I think you should have a working farm with some things that you keep around for breeding purposes. Like repositories are junk. A lot of people are out here trying to make repositories, especially for hickories, and I do not believe in that. I had an 18-year-old come up to me at the NNGA conference last year, and he was like, "Can I get these varieties? Like, I want to, have my clone bank and my repository of, these species." And I'm like, "I'll send you Scion anytime, but like." Yeah, you should probably have a couple of trees just to clone them if you're going to sell them. But like, put in a production orchard and get some nuts off of it. Like, value the tree for what it is. Otherwise, you're never going to know what a good tree is. You're just going to have to trust me. And I mean, I'm kind of a trustworthy guy. But you should get your own opinion on what a good milking tree, a good automated cracking tree is, a good oil pressing tree, and, a good home cracking tree is. I have my opinions, but like I will say, everyone who came before, most of the people that came before me do not have a good sense for what a good tree is. Even I love John Gordon. He was a breeder in Ontario, Canada, and I trust his opinion. The persimmons that he puts out, he loves Proc, he loves Geneva Long, he loves Piper, he loves all these great trees. And like those trees are good. They do have some issues. They're still not great. I respect his opinion. For hickories, he thought some of the best trees were Yoder, Porter, Walters, and Nielsen, I believe. That might not be an exact list. But, like, Yoder doesn't crack out for garbage. So my guess is that what he was looking for was a productive tree. If that's on his list, I could be mixing it up. He might have just said Porter. Porter cracks out beautifully, and Walters sounds like it's awesome. And Nielsen, I hear good things about it, and it's pollen sterile, so that's very interesting. That's cool. I do respect John Gordon's opinion, but Yoder, that's said to be one of the best trees throughout history for hickory, and I don't like it. And I think there's a lot of trees out there that I don't like. In fact, even Granger, one of the best, most highly rated trees in history, I don't really like it.
Is the
Like, it doesn't.
performance of some of these select clones very situational? Like, when they might have been selected in one location where they performed well, but when you move them, it doesn't translate easily to slightly different locations.
It is possible somewhat, for sure. Like Granger in Pennsylvania, it's only like 50% self-husking, which I view as like somewhat of an issue for production. And it's biennial in Pennsylvania at a couple of different sites. The biennality could be a fertility thing. The husk self-husking could be a northern thing because it was selected in Tennessee. But the people who love it so much are from Pennsylvania. They are cracking those nuts. They are the ones. Like, Pennsylvania is the epicenter of nut culture in the eastern United States because J.F. Jones and John Hershey were there. And John Hershey selected Granger, and like we've seen nuts off of John Hershey's tree. It's like on his soils. Like, it's not different. Granger has this issue where oftentimes the kernel gets stuck in the corner, which wouldn't be, it might be fine if you're clipping out. Like, most of the NNGA growers clip out their nuts with little clippers. I'm not interested in that. And maybe it would go fine through a sheller, but I gotta test it. And I don't really like it for home cracking purposes, at least right now.
I have a really interesting question. You mentioned mentor pollination before. Have you heard of mentor grafting, that this phenomenon where traits from the rootstock can end up heritably transferring into the scion? And could that be an issue for some of these select varieties if they are grafted for decades, that they eventually, different lines of them, pick up little bits of genetic material from the rootstock through a kind of internal horizontal gene transfer?
I haven't seen that yet on Hickories. I don't know. I haven't seen it yet. Carl Weschke references something in his book that he grafted Weschke onto a bitternut, and it changed shape. And that same shape is the shape that the Weschke tree looks like in Pennsylvania on pecan rootstock. That could be the case. I think it's just a fertility thing, and the fertility makes it change over time,
Do
for that
people often get
situation.
scion wood of the same named variety from two different sources and then graft them side by side and compare the performance? That'd be the real test if you saw one batch
That
performed
would
really
be.
differently to another. But I mean, it could be a disease or something as well. There could be a virus that crept in from, the external environment along the way.
Yeah. There's so much variation between trees and in place, season length, and yeah, we definitely should be doing that. We've identified certain trees like beaver. We've found beaver in like at least three different locations across the Midwest and Eastern United States. And like, yeah, it does look a little different, but the kernel percentages, the way it cracks out, the kernel flavor, a lot of these stay consistent. There's also so much variation within a tree year to year. And I have a couple examples from Badger Set S. I shouldn't be saying specific names like that. There's a Weschke seedling that's pollen sterile in row S, and I've observed it change from 43% kernel to 51% kernel the following year. I've observed that was the only tree in that row that I saw change kernel percentage highly. And then this past last year in the spring, I fertilized really heavily on the back hill. And that appears to have dropped kernel percentages generally, really consistently and a lot. Shiver was down 3% kernel this past year. A couple of different nuts changed kernel percentage down a lot. I think that was from excess available potassium while the nut shell was forming, I think. I don't know. Could have been nitrogen, could have been anything. There's so much variation year to year. Yeah, we need to do more testing, definitely. I'm totally with you. And I'll be doing it. I'll be doing it.
There's so many variables over such a
For sure.
huge time span that it's I'm just a, I'm astonished at the work that you're doing. It's really remarkable.
I have a whole orchard in my valley of shagbark rootstock so that in 5 years I can graft out all of my varieties on the shagbark rootstock. I also have a whole orchard of bitternut rootstock down there so that I can graft all the varieties on bitternut rootstock and see how they do. I'm plant transplanting all of my trees from a grafter on pecan rootstock. And yeah, we'll see how all those varieties do. So we'll have that on the same site. But then even then, there's so much variance in my soil because I'm on garbage soil, where the bedrock is like between, it varies in depth so much that yeah, it's gonna be hard to piecemeal it all together. So I'm trying to have a lot of references across my property of the same clone on the same rootstock. But it's gonna be hard to figure out. There,
We
there's one
should
situation
we've
where
been going a while. We should
there's
probably start wrapping it up, but this has been
yeah,
amazing.
yeah.
But
Okay.
I always
Sorry.
love saving this question for the end. And I think for tree crop people, it's the most fun question. If you could create any crop with like just a wave of a magic wand or, magically living for thousands of years, in the case of tree crops, what would you kind of wish into existence?
I would want, I mean, the obvious answer is the hybrid hickory that can do everything. It can oil press super well. It cracks out perfectly for kernel and an automated cracker and, is super hardy and at a home cracking scale and, yeah, and can be milked so the shell isn't tannic and it's really thin husked and, it has all these disease resistance traits. I would want it all. That said, I also am of the camp that I don't exactly know. Philip Rutter says this: you don't know what you want. Like he's obsessed with these, this is a sidetrack, but he's obsessed with these multi-dimensional bird chestnuts, which could be argued as very important because they have like 12 nuts per burr, and they're like massive. They're just crazy. And he's seen some trees that do this really consistently, some trees that have started doing it after the polar vortex and coppiced, and then they come back and then they start doing it. No one's thinking about multidimensional burrs on their chestnuts, and no one's thinking about, corn on the cob, hazelnuts. Maybe it's all useful. We don't really know, but we got to keep following the weird stuff, because that'll be making the jumps in breeding rather than just progressively making good normal plants over time.
Well, you only have to
So
look at
I
how
don't know.
Teosinte turned into maize, but nobody growing Teosinte for thousands of years could have fully imagined what it was about to transform into. But they just had to keep an open mind and watch their plants and observe and interact.
And even a couple of years ago, I used to just be of the goal where I wanted a really productive, perfectly cracking, really thin shelled hickory because it's nice to have thin shells. But now I'm like, oh, we can oil press these. That's awesome. So I didn't know that. And that took convincing from Jesse Markson. Thank you, Jesse. And I still, yeah, I don't know what we'll want. And yeah, even when you're
Are there any neglected tree crops from North America that you wish could like have, accelerate through a process of domestication, that they're kind of like gems in the rough?
The black oak, I really want someone to work on this. If anyone listening to this is trying to work with black oak and actually is willing to, plant 5 acres out, I'll give you the 5 acres. You can have 5 acres on my property. I don't care. But like, if you're willing to do this work, come and talk to me. There's almost no germplasm collection. You'll be starting from 1900s, so you'll be 100 years behind the hickory. And it'll suck, but black oaks are incredible. They have such good taste. They're, if you do research into Andrew Hipp, I would recommend looking into that. Andrew Hipp is an incredible oak researcher. A lot of the gene exchange is from in the red oak group is from the black oak, and a lot of the gene exchange in the white oak group is from the bur oak. And it goes to the other species and doesn't really come back. The black oak is particularly adapted to the type of soil and the type of aspect, the slope, direction of the slope of my property. And it's also just like a very capable, I think, yeah, drier soils and more tolerant trees are kind of what we need in an agricultural setting. Like the red oak, it really likes to be on really moist, north and east slopes. And I don't think that it could be an agricultural crop. It probably should be, and it's delicious. But the black oak seems like it could be more of an agricultural crop. So call me, find my number online. It's not that hard. Give me a ring.
Brilliant. And the one of the final questions I like asking is, what is your vision for the future of food in your community?
I want more people working on a very small number of things. I want fewer market gardeners. I want more production farmers, and I want more collaboration with the community within a community. I want one person growing all the onions and garlic and all that stuff, and I want someone else growing the hickories. And like, I don't need all my market gardeners to be growing hickories too. I'll hook you up. You hook me up. We'll be good. That'd be pretty nice.
I mean, it could be the ultimate like neo-feudalist model of land access, that like it's not that you own this particular patch of land. You can grow anywhere in the village, but you have one particular species that's your responsibility, and you have to kind of negotiate to find where that fits in with everyone else's particular totem plant.
That would be beautiful for sure. And there's like, since civilization is almost defined by specialization, and like, yeah, we all want to do it all, and we all do a little bit of it all because that's nice to do. Like, you don't need to do a lot of bit of everything. So, yeah. Sure.
Brilliant. The final plug, if people want to learn more about your work or maybe get in touch if you're open to that, you don't have to be. You put a call out there, but what's the best way if people want to follow up on anything that you do?
I have a website. You can look up Dispersion Farms on Google. It kind of comes up. Facebook groups, the North American Hickory Hickan something group. That's I posted a decent amount to there, and then the nut processors group. Any nut processing stuff, I try to post there. And then I have a YouTube channel under Alex Tanky. You could, I don't know how you'll find it, but you can do
I'll
it.
put all of the links in the show notes to make it easy for people.
My phone number is just on my website. Try not to get it anywhere else because those
Yeah,
spam callers just call me like 5+ times a day. It's horrible. And
it's
it
always when you're in the,
comes up
like,
every
you're
time.
dangling with a chainsaw or something and you think it's important.
It's the worst. It could be my partner calling because she's about to, she needs my help and she's in the emergency room, but it's just a, your Google listing is, it's horrible. So, but you can call me anytime. I pick up pretty reliably.
Brilliant, brilliant. Okay, well,
Thank you.
I'll say thank you for an amazing
Thank you.
talk. I'm so inspired by what you're achieving in your part of the world, and if I can just do a 1% of what you guys have achieved in my little corner of the world, then I'll be happy with what I'm going to do with the rest decades of my life.
You can do more than 1%. You can do 100%.
Yeah.
Thank you for doing what you're doing, though. I appreciate it. It's really important.
The Zero Input Agriculture Podcast is a solo passion project built with my ample time and meager resources. If you would like to support the show, then sign up for a paid subscription to my Zero Input Agriculture blog at Substack. As a reward, you can read all my past posts and listen to the audiobook of Taming the Apocalypse. If you prefer reading about the past and future of biological technology, you can read the ebook of Taming the Apocalypse through Amazon. And finally, please rate and review the show on whatever podcast app you use, since it helps other people find me, or recommend the show directly to anyone who could use some inspiration to become a plant breeder themselves.